Hello everyone, my name is Tomasz. I am the founder and editor of Fujilove magazine, and this is another episode of the Fujilove podcast, where we talk all things Fujifilm X-Series and interview Fujifilm photographers. On today's show, our podcast host, Jens Krauer, official Fujifilm X photographer from Switzerland, is having a wonderful conversation with Ibarionex Perello. Ibarionex is a great photographer himself. He is also a blogger, a workshop leader, but most of us know him as a host of his own photography podcast, one of the longest existing photography podcasts out there, The Candid Frame. Before we start with today's episode, here are just a few words from our podcast sponsors, 500px and Alien Skin Software. I would really like to personally thank them for their ongoing support. 500px, wonderful community of photographers and the world's leading photo sharing site. I have been sharing my own photographs on several different platforms, and 500px is definitely the one which I recommend the most. Your photos will shine and look really beautiful on their site. So join millions of photographers who share already their photos, learn and grow together with them every day. 500px.com.
I'm Kevin Mullins, a UK-based documentary photographer, official Fujifilm X photographer, and longtime subscriber to Fujilove. This episode is sponsored by Alien Skin, creators of Exposure X3, the advanced photo and RAW editor. I've been using Alien Skin Exposure for the last few years and seen the application mature into a fully featured RAW editor. I particularly like the way that the Exposure film presets allow me to get something magical from the Fujifilm RAW files at the touch of a button. Exposure is quick to use, easy to use, and can act as a standalone product or a plugin to Lightroom and Photoshop. Download a free trial now and get 10% off with the coupon code FUJILOVE.
Welcome to the FUJILOVE podcast. Today's guest is Ibarionex Perello, a photographer, writer, educator, and the host of the Candid Frame podcast. He has been in and around the photographic industry for 25 years as a professional in many fields. And as I got to know today, he's also a professor. So, Professor Perello, how are you today?
I'm good. Thank you.
So just out of curiosity, because you're the first photographer I meet that is actually a professor, how did you become a professor?
Well, I'm an adjunct professor, which means that I'm not going through the usual procedures for being a professor at a college. It's the Art Center College of Design. And it just so happened I was at a party. I met the photo department head, and we hit it off. And then I got together with him for lunch, and he said, "Hey, do you want to teach a class up here?" And I was like, "I guess that would be fun." And that's exactly what happened. So I started teaching a class called Working Photographer, which I taught for several years. Unfortunately, the class is no longer being offered because the content of the class was split into several different classes. So I still would love to return there to teach again, but it was a good run.
I'm a huge fan of the Candid Frame, and given that you host one of my favorite podcasts ever, I want to take the opportunity to ask you now, after like 408 episodes in the meantime, can you let us know how this came together? How did it start, and how did it grow into the institution that it is today?
Working as an associate editor for Outdoor Photographer magazine and Digital Photo Pro magazine here in the Los Angeles area. And I live in the Pasadena area, and the offices was near Santa Monica, which is a distance of about 30 miles, which doesn't mean anything relatively, because in Los Angeles, you don't measure distance in miles or kilometers, you measure it in time. So to travel 30 miles here was like an hour to get to work and an hour and a half to get back. So there was a lot of idle time stuck in traffic. And so I just wanted a diversion while I was in the car. And at first, I started listening to a lot of books on tape. And then somehow I discovered this thing called podcasts. And this was even before iTunes started having its own iTunes store to distribute podcasts. You had to use third-party aggregators in order to sort of find podcasts and to download them. And I just started listening to podcasts during my commute. And I gravitated automatically to any content regarding to photography. And what was happening is that a lot of the content gravitated and focused on equipment and discussion of gear. And because I wrote for the magazines and I was constantly writing about that stuff, I really wasn't interested in hearing more about equipment. I mean, I wrote about that stuff 5 days a week. So I thought, well, you know, someone should interview photographers and talk about photography, talk about the process, talk about the business of photography. And then I went, well, I know all these photographers. I know how to interview people from all my years of writing. Why don't I just do it? And I didn't know anything about recording audio or editing audio or even how to upload a podcast or build a website or anything like that. So I just borrowed the digital recorder from a friend and conducted my first interview. And then I just scoured the internet for any information about how you create a podcast. How do you edit audio? And I've been doing it ever since. It's going on 12 years. As you mentioned, we have over 408 episodes so far. And it's kind of going strong. I love the fact that I've had an opportunity to interview some of my photographic heroes, people that I grew up admiring. But I think more importantly, I've been able to create something that really resonates with a lot of photographers all over the world. I've been told countless numbers of times that the show has really helped people to pursue their dreams with respect to photography, whether it was, you know, starting a business or just making photography a bigger part of their lives. I hear all the time from people who are not only entertained by the show, but are really inspired by it. So I'm really grateful for that and the way it's really helped to shape my life over the last decade.
Yeah, and I share that experience. For me, when I got into photography, your podcast was one of the first ones I discovered. And ever since then, I exactly enjoy this kind of guidance outside of technical aspects. So I assume you get a lot of feedback how valuable it is for especially photographers that start out.
Yeah. I mean, I always, when I get an email or a text message or something on, you know, Twitter or something like that, it really heartens me to know that it's making a difference. You know, because I'm in this little bubble. I work out of my house and, you know, I don't have any regular interaction with people on a day-to-day basis other than when I'm teaching a workshop or doing something along those lines. And then I have a chance to meet listeners and I get to meet people face-to-face and find out what the show means to them. So, you know, anytime that I get that kind of feedback is really valuable to me. And it's, you know, it's encouraging because sometimes you're recording, you're talking into a microphone and you wonder, is anybody listening? And it's nice to know that people are, and that people are really enjoying what we're producing here.
Well, they definitely do. Do you remember who your first guest ever was?
Oh yeah, that was John Isaac. He is, was a UN photographer for many years. He was a friend of mine through my work at the magazine, because we had profiled him and he had submitted images to numerous articles at the magazine. And he was in town to speak at Art Center, where I would eventually teach. And I said, hey, John, I'm starting this podcast and I'd like to interview you for the show. And he said, well, I'm going to be in Pasadena. And I met him in the hotel dining area. He was having dinner, and we sat there and I interviewed him. And if you go back to that episode, you'll hear the clattering of all the utensils in the background.
I actually remember that.
There's a lot of noise in that background, but I didn't know any better at the time. But you know, it is what it is. And that's the interview that started everything.
Do you ever get nervous before you interviewed somebody?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are a couple of times when there are photographers who I just love, photographers whose work I've just admired forever, like Mary Ellen Mark was one of them. William Albert Allard, Bill Allard was another one. And usually it's people whose work I have just grown up on. It's like I'm a real fanboy, and just to have the chance to sit down and to talk to them about their work that I've been so immersed in for years always makes me a little nervous. But once we start talking, I just get into the groove of things and my nervousness goes away.
Yeah, I share the experience. Do you, in retrospect, is there any guest that kind of, I'm not saying who's your favorite guest, but was there a guest that impressed you the most by what he said or added to the conversation?
Oh, wow. I really couldn't. Honestly, I couldn't say whether there is. It's so many people that I've talked to. I would say probably in general, some of the photographers who I've gained some of the most insight from are photographers that aren't household names. They're just photographers that were just going out producing some interesting work, and they just would say something that really resonated with me and eventually would resonate with a lot of people that are listening to the show. You know, one of my favorite guests is Joel Meyerowitz, who's going to be on an episode in the near future again. And he's just a man who opens his mouth and jewels just fall out. So he's probably one of my favorite guests, but I think that overall, I always take away something valuable from every person that I sit down and talk with. And I think that's really sort of the key. One of the keys to the success of the show is that one of the comments I get a lot of is that people will say, you know, I listened to the episode about this photographer that shoots X, Y, and Z. I'm not interested in that genre of photography, but I still got a lot out of it. And I think that that's because we really focus more on process, on the journey of, you know, the life choices people have to make to be able to make photography a part of their lives, whether or not they're making a living from photography or not, because many of my guests are not professional photographers. They're just photographers that are working on creating really amazing personal work. And that just resonates with me. And that's why I want to talk with them. And I think if anything that I want people to take away from when they listen to the show is that there's no singular path to making a creative life. I think too many people think there's only one path. There's only one way you can go. And I think my show demonstrates over those 408 episodes, there are so many ways to make this a part of your life.
Yeah, we just talked off the air before we started recording, and I shared his experience. When I discovered your podcast, I found so much guidance and also motivation in listening to these various approaches on how to live with photography or with a creative goal in life, because it's not easy in the end.
No. And it's really encouraging to hear people who are finding a way to surmount any variety of obstacles in order to make things happen, whether it's, you know, restrictions of time, restrictions of access, you know, family issues, disabilities, whatever excuse stops so many people. So many of the my guests on my show have not allowed those things to keep them from going out and making their pictures. And I think that for me is something I always need to hear, because I have 100 million excuses as to why I shouldn't be doing something, even though I'm really feeling propelled to do it. And these conversations remind me, it's like the only person that stopped me from doing anything is me. There's no one saying, oh, I'm the gatekeeper and you can't do this. It's really my own decision-making or my lack of decision-making that keeps me from making some things happen in my life. And when I talk to someone who's doing it, especially when they're only been doing photography for a very short period of time and they've produced some amazing work and they've created an amazing career for themselves, I'm like, wow, that's possible. And it's good to be reminded of that, because I think one of the things is that you hear people say, you hear no a lot, but I think the person who's usually saying no the most is ourselves rather than anybody else. So I like these people who I interview, because they're saying yes to themselves more often than not. And that's why they're able to succeed in any variety of different ways.
Yeah, and they're passionate and they take risks. And that's incredibly inspiring, especially to understand what circumstances they overcome and what they struggle with in their day-to-day activities. So before we dive into your cover story for the Fuji Love magazine, I'm wondering, because you're 25 years in the photography industry, what would you say, looking back, were the most significant changes over the last 25 years that stand out to you?
I've been around long enough that digital was transitioning, because it's actually 30 years now, I think. So when I came into the industry, my first professional job out of college was working with Nikon. And at that time, the only digital that was really being used by professionals were digital scanners, flatbed scanners, and film scanners. There had been some digital stuff that had come out, but Nikon was just getting into it. There was no really professional product other than these hybrids that were produced by Kodak, which used Canon and Nikon bodies on these devices that allowed you to capture a digital image that at the time may have been like 1 megapixel or 2 megapixel. I can't even remember. So when I was at Nikon, I was around for that transition when they finally came out with the camera that was the D1, which was the first Nikon-branded digital SLR, which changed the game. Because the Kodak machines, I think their prices were somewhere between like $25,000, and they were used primarily by photojournalists. And then Nikon came out with this camera, and I think it was valued at about $10,000 or $8,000, which sounds like a lot now, but at the time it was markedly less expensive than what was being offered by Kodak. And then that sort of changed the game. And then I transitioned to the digital division, and I learned everything digital. I learned about scanning. I started learning about digital photography, about Photoshop. And then I transitioned to the magazine, which was another opportunity to be immersed not only in stuff Nikon, but stuff Canon, stuff Olympus, Panasonic, you know, Photoshop, everything digital I had access to in one way or another. So it provided me, you know, my education into transitioning from the world of film to the world of from digital. So for me, undoubtedly, the biggest change in my lifetime has been that transition.
And now it becomes hip again to shoot analog. So you must be home in that field.
Not so much. I mean, I've been there and done that. I like the darkroom. I like the black and white darkroom. But the only reason I like the black and white darkroom is the fact that I don't have any distractions in there. But, you know, I look at the price of paper now. You know, for 50 sheets of silver 8x10 paper. And it's like, no, I think I'll pass on this. You know, that stuff is so expensive. I used to buy these boxes, 250 sheet boxes, for maybe $50 or something like that. And I don't even know how much they are now. But it's more money than I want to spend. And I was never that good of a printer anyway. So I may on occasion shoot a roll of film, but it takes me forever to process it. So for me, I'm all digital. As much as I love the look of film, I leave that to other photographers to do.
Well, I can only imagine how it was in analog days, because I wasn't around. But the fact that you can just shoot and shoot and shoot and take pictures home and you have them immediately, to me, that is so much easier than anything people tell me about analog.
And one of the things I got spoiled at Nikon is because they wanted you to be familiar with the equipment, because I was a technical support rep, and that meant that people would call in the 1-800 number and ask us questions about equipment. And so I had to have information in my brain about every piece of Nikon equipment going back to 1956.
Wow.
And as well as the current stuff. And as part of them encouraging us to know the equipment was, here's film, go out and shoot, and we pay for the processing. So every weekend I was grabbing bricks of film and going out and shooting. And I didn't have to pay for any of it. The only time I needed to pay for anything was when I wanted to make my own black and white prints. But otherwise, I was shooting endless numbers of chrome film and color negative film. And, you know, I was incredibly spoiled. I definitely took advantage of it. But it was also part of my job. And then when I worked at the magazines, by that time, we had transitioned to digital. So we would shoot some film, but not very much. For about 15 years, I was always involved in some way with photography, and in as well as doing my work, I was constantly learning and keeping updated with everything that was going on.
So you must have somewhere at home a lot of negatives still from that time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of negatives that at some point need to get scanned. I don't know when that's going to happen. I keep meaning to do that. But yeah, it's got boxes and boxes of slides and negatives in the office here that at some point I'm going to have to do something with.
How and when did Fuji come into play for you?
I think I played a bit with Fuji when I was at the magazine, because I think we had the S1. Is that the...
I think so. I couldn't confirm.
This was before the X series. So they had the Fuji, I think it was an S1. And I played with that and I really enjoyed it. But in terms of really using a Fuji camera, that didn't happen until, I want to say, 5 years ago now, 5 or 6 years ago. I had some friends who were using the Fuji cameras, and I saw this X100 and X100S. And I was going on a trip to Paris, and my friend was kind enough to lend me the camera for the trip. And it just changed everything. At the time, I had a Canon DSLR and about 6 or 7 lenses. And I took this on my first trip to Europe, and I just fell in love with this camera that was incredibly small, that I could take with me everywhere, that I could put into a coat pocket, and was perfectly suited to my sensibility as a street photographer. It's, you know, the equivalent of a 35 millimeter lens was the perfect focal length for me. And I just love the fact that this camera was as responsive and just felt seamless in my hand. And once I started shooting with that, I ended up buying my own X100S, which I still use today. And that's been my primary camera for a long time. I sold all my Canon gear, and I was going to invest in something else. And I was thinking Fuji, but that money ended up getting redirected to something else. So that didn't happen. I do have a Samsung NX1 system because I was shooting some work for Samsung, and they provided me the equipment, but unfortunately they went out of business. So I still have that camera, but primarily when I go out and shoot, it is my X100S that's with me all the time. In fact, I went to softball practice today. I play in a 50 and up league, and I made some images today with my X100S, and I just love the fact that I could put it in my bag and pull it out when I want to make a photograph. I don't have to be burdened by this large DSLR with all this weight and all this bulk. And, you know, I have a camera that's small enough and compact enough to use anytime, and that provides amazing image quality.
So your first Fuji is still your actual Fuji today?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Can you let me know, you're a street photographer. Would you mainly call yourself a street photographer?
I would. I really hate the word street photography now, just because there's so many people who lay claim to that name. And I think that it's not... There was a phrase that used to be used to describe this kind of photography, which was candid photography. And I think this was probably a term that was used way before like the 70s or... It was this idea that you're out in the world making photographs. And I think I'm leaning towards describing myself more along those lines as a candid photographer, because I think the word street photography is kind of loaded with assumptions about what it is and what it isn't. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you go online, you see all these arguments about people saying this is street photography, this isn't, blah, blah, blah. And for me, I've always liked photographing on the street. I've always loved the unpredictability of the street, of just being out in the world where people are active, living out their lives, and just the environment and finding interesting things that I can compose within the frame and make for an interesting photograph. So for me, that's probably a truer reflection of who I am as a photographer rather than just, you know, accepting that easy label of street photographer. But for lack of a better term, yeah, that's what I am.
Okay, because, I mean, I agree with you. Street photography, according to different article, dies every 6 months, and people argue about what is street photography and what isn't. Mm-hmm. What makes you, is it the spontaneous nature, or is it because you like to search? What makes you grab your camera, go out and say, today I'm going to see what the world has to offer to me?
What I love about it is that it's completely unpredictable. I like the fact that I can go out there using a complete blank slate, that with no agenda on my part, I can suddenly see a convergence of light, shadow, line, shape, color, and gesture. And within a fraction of a second, I can make something beautiful. I can make something that will evoke a reaction in the viewer when they look at the photograph. I love that challenge. I love the challenge of going out in a situation where most people would never consider making a photograph and creating something that excites me. For me, I like that moment of discovery, even more than actually making the photograph, seeing the play of light against the building and seeing how the people moving through that scene help give it life. And then just recognizing that. And then the challenge becomes, can I make a photograph that reflects that moment of discovery that I had when I saw it with my naked eye? There's just something about that challenge and being able to succeed with it that for me is intoxicating. So anytime that I get out there, for me, I'm in the pursuit of that feeling. It's if I make, even on days when I don't succeed in making the photographs, I can often take satisfaction from just having recognized those moments. And of course, I always want to come away with a really good photograph. But for me, the practice of photography is really the practice of seeing. And sometimes I take pleasure in seeing, even if I'm not making photographs, if I'm in my car and I'm just driving down the road and I just see this wonderful play of light and shadow and I can just appreciate it, where I know everyone around me is just completely oblivious to it. And it's something that means a lot to me. And it's one of the things I love teaching other people to do, is to rediscover how to see.
Which a lot of people actually tend to forget. But it also means that you need to embrace insecurity and be open to accept whatever comes your way and enjoy the process actually more than the results.
I couldn't have said it better. That's exactly what it is. It's photography is a process, and you have to learn how to take pleasure in the process and not be so obsessed with the outcome, because the photography is a numbers game. You know, most times when you go out, you're going to make photographs that are okay, some may be good, and every once in a while you'll make a picture that's great. You know, if you think of the majority of pictures that are on anyone's hard drives, most of the photographs are failures. Not that they're bad photographs, but they don't have all the elements that mean a successful photograph. But that doesn't discount any of those images, because for me, all those images that fall short are the building blocks on which I am eventually able to create a really exceptional photograph. Because I look at those photographs where I've fallen short, where everything didn't work, where the timing was off. And I look at those photographs and I learn from those photographs. I look at those images and I can understand why this is why it didn't work. If I had waited a beat later and made the image, this person would have been in this spot and helped complete the frame. Or if I'd come back and moved a little closer or moved further back, or if I'd gone vertical instead of horizontal, or if, you know, whatever variable I recognize, that teaches me so that when I encounter a similar scene again, which is inevitable that's going to happen, I'm ready for it, because I've had all these countless opportunities before. So when a similar situation presents itself, I know exactly what to do.
Do you think photographers are not critical enough towards themselves, meaning that instant reward and recognition or getting praise online leads to believing that you actually need to produce good work on a daily basis?
I see that in two different facets. In terms of people being too critical, I think in one way they are. I think people are way too hard on themselves. I think they have this idealized idea of what great photography is and this misconception that great photographers always make great photographs. And great photographers make a lot of bad photographs. They just don't show them to you. And I think that the other issue is the pursuit of likes and having people like your photographs. It's dangerous if you start creating pictures solely on the hope that someone else is going to like it. Mm-hmm. Because for me, when I create a photograph and I post it, I am looking at this photograph in a particular way. Usually, I'm looking at it in terms of my growth as a photographer. And I know that some of the photographs that I make are not going to get a lot of likes, because other people will look at it and they'll go, what the hell are you doing? This is, you know, your subject's not off center. It's not using the rule of thirds, or it's underexposed, or whatever it is. But I'm being purposeful in some of the choices that I make, because I'm trying to push my own envelope. I'm trying to take some risks. And what I see in those photographs is me experimenting, challenging myself, taking risks, embracing the possibility of failure. And even if the image isn't perfectly there, I look at that photograph and I share that photograph because I know what I'm going for. I don't simply want to repeat the same images over and over again just because they're liked. I'll see a lot. If people follow me on Instagram, they'll see that, unlike a lot of people who have thousands of people follow them on Instagram who have a very consistent look, I'm kind of all over the place. And that's because I'm always trying to explore different facets of my own seeing. And I'm trying to find myself, and I'm trying to, I think I do have a style. I think that people look at my photographs, they have a sense of what my style is, but I'm not preoccupied with trying to find that one style that sort of defines me. I'm in pursuit of something else. So as much as I like people liking my photographs, I also am okay with people not getting it and people not liking it, and, you know, saying, you know, that they don't like it for this reason or that reason. Sometimes it's valuable feedback. Most times it's not. But I think it's important for people to have a real clear idea of what they're trying to go for. And if it's somebody else's approval, I would think that that's probably the biggest mistake that you can make. Getting feedback is valuable and it can be important, but the ultimate arbiter of whether you're doing what you need to be doing is you, and no one else can or should be telling you that.
I would add to that also, I mean, as a photographer, your goal should be over time to kind of accumulate a lot of good work and kind of put a line into that, and or a message or some kind of a vision. And if you shoot for likes, that's probably going to prevent this approach, because it's a long-term game.
I'm Kevin Mullins, a UK-based documentary photographer, official Fujifilm ex-photographer, and long-time Fuji Love subscriber. Why don't you try out Alien Skin Exposure today? I really love the film presets, especially the moody black and white Kotalith. And of course, there are hundreds more. It's a great application for all of your retouching and editing needs, including grain, vignettes, and overlays. Alien Skin Exposure boasts great workflow, tools, its speed, and quick and easy to use. Download a free trial today and get 10% off with the code FUJILOVE.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your article, which is not so far away from what we've discussed. I was surprised that after 25, or in the meantime, 30 years in photography, you were shaken up by actually changing from the X100S to the X-T2. Tell us a little bit about how that happened.
Yeah, I was invited to go down to South Africa to teach at an event on street photography in Johannesburg. And they put me in touch with the Fuji rep down in Johannesburg, who provided me an X-T2 to work with while I was down there. And I had played with the X-Pro, I think X-Pro 2 a little bit for a couple of days, but never with the X-T2. And I was like, oh, this should be really interesting. And one of the big reasons I was curious about it, I was wanting to see the difference in AF performance. So I got the camera. And I was in Johannesburg for a week. And the first couple of days, I really struggled, because I had been using the X100S for so long, I didn't even have to look at the camera in order to make changes to aperture, to my exposure compensation, to, you know, everything was just right where I knew it should be. And I could make changes really quickly. and I could just focus more on shooting and seeing. Get the X-T2 and things are located differently, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and that unfamiliarity was an obstacle, because I was so ingrained with thinking about handling the X100S that all of a sudden I had this other camera that I had to learn. So for the first couple of days, I kept missing shots just because the camera wasn't what I expected. But after about the third day, I finally started getting into the groove of it, especially the responsiveness of the shutter release button, because you get used to the millisecond between you pressing a button and actually making a picture, right? And even though it's milliseconds, that for me is critical timing, because for me, with street photography, I'm not taking the picture when the person is at the spot I want them to be. I'm taking the picture a millisecond before that person is in the spot where I want them to be. And so I really needed to get used to the difference in that respect with the X-T2S compared to the X100S, because there is a delay, because the X100S, you know, there's the time it takes to autofocus and then to, you know, release the shutter. And I had to get accustomed to what was happening with the X-T2. But once I started getting used to that, and I kind of got familiar to, okay, how do I access the exposure compensation? How do I adjust for the white balance? How do I change the metering? All those things that I would need to do on the fly. I started getting more and more into it. And by the third and fourth day, I was fully in back into the moment. And I really love that, because I want the camera to be invisible. I don't want a camera where I'm constantly having to look at it, second guess it, figure it out. I need everything where it needs to be. I need to be able to access those key controls as fast as possible. And I just needed to deliver and perform. And it certainly did that, especially with respect to the autofocus performance. I was really pleased with that. But just the overall feel and handling was really seductive. So when I got back to my X100S, it was just like, oh, man. It was a little hard to get back to it, because I was quickly getting used to using the X-T2 within a very short period of time.
I was just about to ask, like, when you were back home, how fast did you miss the X-T2?
Oh, I was missing it the day I handed it over. Okay. I was just like, do I really have to give this back? You know, he's not going to miss it. He has a lot of cameras.
They do.
But I did. But I did. And but I've yet to commit to getting an upgrade yet. And I'm actually going to write an article next week for my own blog about, you know, I posed a question to myself and I felt like, you know, there's so many cameras that I see that I get seduced by when they first come out. Oh, that looks really good. I should spend my money on that. And I said, you know, the one question I have to ask myself is the camera that I have now prohibiting me from making the kinds of pictures that I really need to make? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a different question then I think most photographers ask themselves when they want to buy something, because they go, do I have the money? You know, I want it. I don't necessarily need it, but I want it, right? I want the latest and the greatest. But for me, it's I have to say, is the camera I have now a problem? And I think for the longest time, it's not been an issue for me, even the slowness of the autofocus. But in the last couple of weeks, the fact that I find myself gravitating to wanting to shoot in close proximity to people as they're moving towards me at a distance of 3 feet and closer, I'm finding that the camera is not focusing fast enough for me to do that. And I know that you could preset the autofocus and, you know, do zone focusing, but I want the autofocus to do it for me. If I have to start thinking about zone focusing, you know, my subjects aren't always going to be at 3 feet or closer. Sometimes they're going to be 12 feet. So I don't want to have to constantly be thinking about, okay, oh, what's the aperture I got to shoot at? What's the, you know, the hyperfocal distance that I have available to me? All that other stuff. That's more stuff that I have to think about. I'm trying not to think about all that technical stuff. So I need a camera that will be able to give me what I need with that. I leaned towards using the X100F, but I've not really had a chance to use it. I really was seduced by the X-T2 now that they got this XH1 out there, which I've heard is, you know, has even better AF performance than the X-T2. It's like, well, I'm going to have to rent this stuff and really see whether it makes a difference for me in that respect. It's not just the AF performance. Of course, it's going to be like the handling and just the overall performance. But for me, that's the big issue now. And I think I'm getting to the point where the X100S is starting to stand in my way. But I think it's not just because I just want the latest and the greatest, because people look at the camera that I'm using that's the big question. Why haven't you upgraded? Right? Why are you using this camera that's like 5 or 6 years old now? That's two generations old. And it's like, well, you know, up until now, I've been able to make all the pictures that I need with this camera without any problem. That's why. But now it's like, I may have to open up the bank account and spend some ducats.
Well, you probably have to. I mean, I'm with you on the approach. I usually tell in workshops that rather than buying new cameras, use that device until you've learned it inside out and you can actually use it blindly in any situation. But then there comes the point where actually things become attractive in new cameras. So I've been able to play with the XH1, and for me, I'm not going to upgrade to that one because I'm waiting for next generation. I'm super happy with the thing I have right now. So I share your approach. But in regards to your blog that you're going to write for next week, what would it take to make you actually want to change to a certain model?
Right now, it's if I find that, for me, the one issue right now is that focusing distance of 3 feet or closer. How fast does it focus at that distance? And I'm likely going to be looking at, I guess it's the 23 millimeter. I guess they have two 23 millimeters for the X-T2 and the XH1. So I'm going to have to get my hands on that and go out and shoot with them and see whether or not the performance is different enough and reliable enough for me to make the switch. And if not, if it's still not there, then I'm just going to hold off. You know, because right now I can still make the great majority of my photographs and I'm able to do it. And if, you know, if I do know that I need to shoot at 3 feet or closer, the one workaround for me is to pre-focus at that distance, lock the focus, and then wait for my subject to come into that distance. And that's what I've been doing. But I really would like a camera that doesn't require me to take that additional step in order to make a shot at that close of a distance.
Well, if you give the X-T2 a shot, I can totally recommend it. I use it ever since it came out, but then maybe the H1 is one for you. So I think testing them for a few days is probably the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I'll know immediately. It was just, you know, when it delivers what I need to deliver, then at that point, the credit card's going to be swiped and I'm going to have some explaining to do to my wife.
When I look through your images from South Africa, you're also using different lenses and focal lengths. How did that feel after having a fixed lens for years?
Yeah, I think they gave me a zoom lens. I forget which one. It's one of the kit lens, zoom lens, the one that doesn't have the aperture on the...
It's the 18 to 135.
It was a little awkward just because I had to think about what focal length I wanted to use at any given time. And what I started to do was just reset it to about the equivalent of 35 millimeters. You know, I would make a photograph at whatever focal length, and then I'd go back to the 35 millimeter focal length, just so I knew what my starting point was. Because I don't like using zoom lenses because, you know, if you zoom out to the telephoto focal length and all of a sudden you see a scene and you really want the wide angle, you raise the camera to your eye and then you realize, oh, I got to zoom it back out. And for me, that can make or break me. That can make the difference between getting the shot and not getting the shot. That's why I tend to prefer fixed focal lengths. And while I'll likely get, if I do get an X-T1 or an XH1, I'll probably get like a 23, and I may get the a zoom lens just for the professional work that I do. But the prime will be the you know, my primary lens, I think. But you know, other than just getting adjusted to having a variety of different focal lengths available to me, that was the only sort of thing that I had to get comfortable with, right? In terms of transitioning those initial days. Because like I may sound like a broken record, but I don't want to have to think about the camera, any aspect of the camera. You know, I set my ISO, I set my white balance, I set my aperture, I set my autofocus points, and I just want to be able to see, respond, and make the photograph. And then if I need to make some adjustment on the fly, I can do that within a second or two and then get back to seeing.
Just the things you mentioned, the white balance, etc. Do you really adjust them? Because there's much easier ways to deal with that.
Yeah, I do that because I like paying attention to the quality of the light. So I will tend to, even though I shoot raw, but if I know I'm going to be shooting consistently in daylight, in bright sunny days, I'll just set the white balance to sunny. If I go into open shade, I'll just choose the open shade preset or cloudy or whatever it is. I find that the presets are often much better than the auto, especially when you're in open shade on some cameras. And even though I can adjust it on the fly, I like there's a difference between the white balance that's produced by the camera and then the white balance that you get when you're making the adjustment in Adobe Lightroom. It's not exactly the same thing. The other thing is I'm usually using aperture priority, and so I'm writing the exposure compensation dial all the time, usually no more than 2/3 of a stop up or down. And, in terms of metering, I'm usually using the multi-pattern metering system. Sometimes I'll use the center-weighted if I want to sort of concentrate on a certain area. You know, and that's about it. Those are the sort of the key controls. And the other thing, of course, is the autofocus, the ability to control the autofocus. And that joystick for me was probably one of the biggest reasons why I love the X-T2 as opposed to the X100S, because changing the AF point on the X100S is a two-step affair.
It is.
Right? You have to push that button up, and then you have to choose your AF point. And those two motions are two motions that separate me from me making the photograph.
Correct, because so you're losing time.
Right, and that joystick eliminates that issue. Yeah, I think that was the hardest thing to have to go back to on the X100S was not having the joystick.
Black and white or color?
Well, I always shoot color because I'm shooting raw. And then I kind of, when I look at the images in Lightroom, that's when I decide whether or not I'm going to convert them over to black and white. So that's usually my modus operandi. I love the Akros look. Mm-hmm. So when I do see a scene that I think I'm going to like in black and white, then I'll do use the JPEG, the RAW plus JPEG. In order to take advantage of that. Because you get those simulations that you can get after the fact in Lightroom, but it's not the same.
It isn't. I believe the JPEGs look amazing out of the camera. I usually take the JPEGs out of the camera where I kind of glue the film simulation into it, because I just think they look better.
Yeah. I mean, I've tried to emulate like the one that emulates Kodachrome.
It's Chrome, actually. It's my absolute favorite, and you should absolutely give it a shot to convert Chrome into black and white.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things I've been doing. I don't get Chrome, and I don't get the Akros in my X100S. And I look at those files, and I go, oh, God, I wish my camera did that. But, my next camera will certainly do that.
It's one more reason that works in your favor.
One more reason.
Well, I was wondering, because I saw the one shot from the protest that you mentioned in the article.
Oh, yeah.
And I see you're actually lifting the camera up to your eye. Have you found any use in the tilt screen?
Oh, I love the tilt screen. Yeah. That's most definitely going to be why I'm leaning towards the X-T2 and the X-H1 rather than the X100F, because that tilt screen, I really enjoy it. Because now with the X100F, I'm often having to sort of drop down, crouch down in order to shoot from waist level, because I'm still trying to look for the viewfinder. I don't shoot from the hip where I'm shooting blindly. I'm using the LCD or I'm using the viewfinder in order to compose my shots. So when I'm getting down, it's like with the X100S, I have to physically get down in order to shoot from that perspective. So having that tilty screen is valuable to me. And as you said, with those shots at the demonstration, that really helped me to get a perspective that I otherwise would not have had. Because I carefully compose all my photographs. I'm not the kind of person who wants to or likes to crop after the fact. I will, but for the great majority of the time, all my images are relatively uncropped. So having the articulated screen really allows me to take photographs from unusual perspectives, but to be able to still be able to compose my shots in exactly the way that I want, because I'm always scanning the edges of my frame, because there is where I find most of the distractions. And so I want to be able to move further in or move further back or shift to the left or the right to eliminate those distractions rather than relying on cropping it later. I hate those surprises that when you open up the image, all of a sudden you go, oh, I didn't see that, and that ruins the shot. I want to be able to recognize that stuff when I'm shooting so that I can make a conscious choice as to what I'm going to do with it. And sometimes I can't do anything about some distraction in the background and I still make the photograph. But for me, what's important is that I recognize that it was there while I was shooting and that it didn't surprise me later. Because if it surprised me later, I ask myself, how carefully were you actually seeing when you were making your photographs? Were you just raising the camera, your eye, pressing the button and hoping you get something good? Or were you really proactive in terms of composing this photograph? And that's one of the reasons I challenge myself all the time to be completely present, completely in the moment, so that every millimeter in that frame I'm conscious of.
We're going towards the end as we're running out of time. What is your favorite photographer, or which photographer do you turn to when you look for inspiration?
Ooh, that's a question I always ask of my guests. And for me, it's always changing. Right now, I would have to say that it's Fred Herzog, who is a Canadian photographer out of Vancouver. I discovered his images several years ago. And he's sort of a contemporary of Gary Winogrand, Joel Meyerowitz, William Eggleston. He started photographing Vancouver, I think, in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. And I was at an event called Paris Photo that was held here in L.A. And it was set at the it was staged at the Paramount Sound Stages. And there were just thousands of photographs that were being exhibited by all these different curators. And I remember walking around being unimpressed by most of it. And then I saw one of Fred's prints hanging up on a wall, and I literally stopped and I just stared at it. And then I walked over there and I saw his pictures, and I got the book, and he's just a marvelous photographer. The way that he uses color, and most of his work was shot on Kodachrome, on slide film. And I look at his pictures, and there's such beauty and subtlety to his imagery. The way he uses light, shadow, color, the way he composes the frame. It's amazing. It's amazing for the photography. He may not be as well known as some of the other photographers I compared him to, but I heartily recommend anybody pick up a book of his and look through those images and not be impressed and inspired by the work, especially considering that he didn't have the advantage of the technology that we have available to us today. And I think he's in his 80s. And from what I've heard from people who live up in Vancouver, he's still actively shooting. I've not seen his contemporary work to know how different how he's developed, but just seeing the work that he produced during his period of time, those three decades from the 50s to the 70s, I love looking at those images over and over again. I learned so much by just taking a look at his photographs. It's nothing short of amazing.
It's incredibly beautiful work. The book is right behind me on my shelf. And for those...
Oh, you do have it. Oh, good, good.
For those who don't know it, look into his work. This is really something that is incredibly inspiring. And also, to close the circle a little bit on what we discussed before, he was one of those guys who was shooting actually for decades before anybody even recognized his work.
Yeah, he's represented by a small gallery in Vancouver. And I'm so glad that they're doing that, because it would have been such a loss to not have a man and his quality of work go unrecognized.
Way in the future, looking back at your photography work, what is the character of your 20 best images?
You know, if anything, what I would want people to look at when they see my photographs is I want them to be surprised that I took a photograph of something that is very familiar to them, but that I revealed it to them with a completely new set of eyes. I want people to challenge the way they see their own world, especially the more ordinary and mundane elements of their world. And I want them to think again about not just looking, but actually seeing what's around them. It's something that I do in my workshops that I take a lot of pleasure in, is being able to reintroduce people to seeing. But I really like it when people see my photographs and they get that joyful, almost childish glee of discovering something through my eyes. So for me, that's my hope. I don't know whether I succeed to the level that I would like to succeed with it, but that's what I'm aiming for, at least.
We're looking forward to more great pictures from you, and also to the next 400 episodes of The Candid Frame, I hope.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
It was great having you on the show, Ibarionex. Is there any last words that you want to share with the Fujilove community?
Just check out the Candid Frame. You can go to thecandidframe.com, and there you'll find all the episodes, as well as my articles and such. And then we do have a Candid Frame app that's available for both Android and for Apple iOS. So that's the easiest way to just delve deep into the archive, because you can download or stream any episode on the show. You can save it on your device. And then if you want to email me or with comments about the show, or if you want to recommend a photographer for me to consider as a guest, you can do all of that directly from the app.
Perfect. I absolutely recommend doing that. And thank you again, Ibarionex. It was a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure, man. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for listening to the Fuji Love Podcast. Stay up to date with Fuji Love. Follow our Facebook page and join the Fuji Love Facebook Readers Group. Head over to www.fujilove.com for all the necessary information. Take good care, and we will talk to you next time.